ta chi a cha cha la cha 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 cha. Fainter there. That'll bring it down there, Charlie. There we are. Yes, sirree. Big Daddy is on the scene. Are you ready in there? All right, everything's set. Listeners are all prepared and ready. They're all present. Big Daddy is here. He's got this two-bit single-button carbon microphone on. We've got all 75 watts of our transmitter booming down into the ground leak that we use to dribble it off into Staten Island somewhere. And we're ready and prepared for a big night. Hi, George. It's time once again for radio to begin here. All these guys been playing around, fooling around all day long. It's time for the big timers to take over. Let's go. I'm just feeling a lot today. Cha-cha-da-da-cha-cha-da-da-cha. Here's a good line. I trimmed a sucker for a roll. And I felt almost out of sight. I took a stroll along the line, set up for all the boys, and just to pass the time away, I dropped in on Kid McCoy. And while I sat there drinking, getting on a mighty stew, a dead swell dame came in the place and sat beside me, too. I asked her if she'd have a drink. She sweetly said she would. And as I gazed into her eyes, I thought I understood. Perhaps you'll think me fickle, pals, but it isn't any dream, for when it comes to peachy looks, that Tommy was the queen. We chewed the rag for quite a while, and I shot the con for fair. And when it comes to spreading salve, you may gamble I was there, Dad. I told her I would place her in a finely furnished flat, and when the joint closed up that night, I had my girlie. Pat. Yeah, razzmatazz. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Bring it up big and solid.
She's got eyes of blue. I never cared for eyes of blue. But she's got eyes of blue. And that's my weakness now.
Oh, Bodio.
She's got dimpled cheeks. I never cared for dimpled cheeks. But she's got dimpled cheeks.
And that's my weakness now.
Oh, my. I would be good, but she loves to bill and coo. I never liked to bill and coo, but she loves to bill and coo. So
that's my weakness now. Bring it up big. I never feared for yellow tea, but she's got yellow tea. And that's my weakness now. Gee, I'm really singing up a fantastic storm. How would you like to hear tonight a square shooter's plea? And if there's anybody I believe seriously is a square shooter, you're listening to him right now. Would you please turn the gain up there? There is too much rough and tumble rottenness in the world today. And once in a while, it's good to hear from a real straight shooter, a square shooter. In fact, years ago, Tom Hicks sent me a... Would you please dig in there? Hey, baby, watch me from... I don't know what the hell you're writing so fantastically fast in there. But would you please look at those records? Stop writing for a minute. I want you to show me the records I've got in there. Just stop doing it for a minute and let me talk here. All right, don't get mad about it, baby. We're doing a show. We're not writing a book. All right, there you go. All right. What? I can't see you holding them upside down, cocka. There. Now, give me the one of the piano there, please. There, that's piano. You got it in your hand. There we go. That's the one. Now, if you will please dig out in there a nice piece of square shooter. Don't look so bugged, honey. I'm doing the show. You're just helping me. Give me a nice piece of square shooter type music and get on the stick. You pick it out. Let's see what you pick out. Mm-hmm. Hey, George, is getting to the point where you disturb the help and they're bugged. All right. La-da-da-da-da. You know, this whole place here thinks we're in the office business. In fact, there's one whole department that thinks we're in the log business. Hey, now, come on, stop being mad. You're all right. Nobody knows who I'm talking to. They may think I'm talking to Jimmy McAleer. La-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Yes, here's a square shooter's plea. Now, if you people... All right, bring it on there, Bridget. Just bring it in there quietly. Yes, that's certainly square. Well, sort of, I guess. That's as good as we can do right here. All right, take it down now and out. Very good. Now, we'll set the scene there for square shooters. Hey, you're really looking bugged tonight, honey. What's the matter? Why don't you step out in the hall, let me continue the show, and you can be mad outside. All right, here we go. Let me walk among toilers while I am on Earth. This is a square shooter's plea, and I'd love to send this to a lot of friends of mine. Let me walk among toilers while I'm on Earth, and be by my honest toil judged of my worth, while judging all men by the spirit within, and not the fine raiment that covers the skin. Let me feel with the stricken a bit of their grief, that I may understand and appeal for relief, and fail not in my duty to neighbor in need. This, by the way, was taken from a calendar, in case you're interested, written by a man named Anonymous, and it was taken from a calendar which was one of the biggest, best-selling calendars in all of history. We never really talk much about calendar art and what effect it's had on people's attitudes. The term calendar art today is kind of a loosely held term, and it doesn't... Hey, what are you writing in there? I'm just curious. No, I'm really curious. All right, she's going to leave. So long. It's a little disturbing to have somebody sit in the studio right the way, then working on. Oh, boy. All right, now let's get back to the show. But I come from a long line of people who live by calendar art. And I have to frankly admit that in the home when I was a kid, all I can remember, we never bought. I don't know whether you come from a family like I did, but I'm going to tell you the kind I came from. We never once, to my knowledge, ever bought a picture. I don't recall our family buying a picture. I don't recall anybody in our family ever really going to an art museum. I can remember going to museums, but they always had bones of dinosaurs and stuff in them. You know, once in a while we went to a museum where they had a lot of old Fords, that kind of stuff. But I can't recall going to an art museum as a kid. In fact, I can't recall actually going seriously to a museum with anybody in the family, unless it was one of those things where the whole Sunday school went and my mother had to go along, something like that. But I don't recall being taken by my mother to the Sunday school or something, you know, official type thing. I went with groups and that kind of thing. But the curious thing that I do recall is that running through the comic strips of my... Now, I don't know whether this has ever been reported much on, but running through the comic strips was a strong anti-art attitude that ran through almost all the comic strips that people really lived by. For example, I used to remember great arguments that my mother and father would have over relative villains that Dick Tracy had, whether or not B.O. Plenty was a better villain than the Mole. This was the art that people really lived by. And, you know, I think that the whole premise of camp, that the whole bit of the camp and the pop and the pop art, I think that much of this premise is built on a false foundation. I mean, a false foundation in the sense that people who are literate and have been educated, really, in a way, are suddenly embracing things which they never embraced as kids. In other words, a kid who grew up in a home where they read the Atlantic Monthly, they read Harper's, they were very official people, the old man went to Princeton, they didn't do much comic strip viewing. I'm sure if they did, it was not done. Do they have comic strips, Bob, in the Wall Street Journal? Well, they have a lot of comics in the Wall Street Journal, but I don't think they know that they are. However, these seem to be the people that are making the big shtick today over the comic strips. They're not really the people who grew up with the comic strips and lived with the comic strips, and it was a comic strip world, as a matter of fact. The other day I walked past the gallery and I see all these people in the gallery and I go in. I have a friend who runs the gallery and I see these people walking around, and suddenly it really hit me hard that I had never seen anybody in my youth ever buy a picture. That was something very... Oh, once in a while, when somebody would get a new dining room suit, they called it. They'd get a new dining room suit at Fritas Furniture Company. They would throw in what they called colorful scenes would be thrown in if you bought the thing before July 1st or something, or if you paid cash. They would, yeah, that's the truth. They would give away pictures. Now, what these pictures were generally consisted of a big modernistic type frames. They called them modernistic. Modernistic type frames with pictures of cows in them. Occasionally, there would be a picture of a Venetian castle and a moat. What real importance or relevance this had to life with northern Indiana, I don't know. But they would buy pictures of horses, too. There was also another picture I remember that I saw in several places when I was a kid of an Indian sitting on a horse. And underneath it, it said something like The End of the Trail. This is a very important picture. But the real pictures that people really dug and lived by came on calendars. Now, that's the whole point of what I'm talking about. There was no lack of beauty or art in our world. It was just that it was not formal art. And so every year, Paswinski's Esso station would send us a calendar. And every year, Mattingly's grocery store would send us a calendar. And every year, there'd be a lot of argument as to whether this year's calendar was better than the last year's calendar. And the pictures on the calendar was the kind of art that people really thought was great. For example, a Boy Scout, Norman Rockwell scene, showing a Boy Scout helping Granny across the street. And, you know, there was always a little chuckle thrown in. For example, you could see that Granny was winking at the artist, letting the artist and us, of course, know that it was really Granny helping the Boy Scout across the street. You know, that kind of stuff. Or there were puppies. There were a continual series of pictures of puppies, usually Cocker Spaniels. And these Cocker Spaniels were far more human, the way they were painted in the pictures. They were far more human than babies or kids. You see, they were very human dogs. And they would be playing ball on the beach to puppies. Or they would be pulling the... That was another one. You know what's a typical example of calendar art? How many have seen, when you walk through Times Square, this advertisement, this giant advertisement that appears every year for this suntan oil? Ski and Sun. Have you seen that one? Where the dog is pulling the diapers off this little girl, or she's got a bathing suit, just the bottom thing, and she's holding this big red ball, and she's looking very cute. She's got pigtails, and this dog is pulling her pants off, and there's a little, just a slight titillation there, you know. But it's really cute kind. It's the kind that grandmother would, you know, click her dentures over and say, isn't that cute? And so, now, that is pure, unadulterated calendar art. Now, I don't know whether that picture ever appeared on a calendar, but it's exactly the kind of picture that would have really made the scene big on Paswinski's Esso station yearly offering of art. Now, that's calendar art. That's genuine calendar art. Another kind of calendar art, of course, is the serious calendar art. This is a kind of art which, that's the humorous calendar. Calendar art did not come only in one flavor. It came in several types, and there was the cute calendar art, like the little girl with the dog, the Boy Scout leading Granny across the street. That's cute calendar art. Then there's serious calendar art. Now, an example of serious calendar art is Norman Rockwell's The Four Freedoms. And it shows these four very official-looking faces of people. You've seen that? That's serious calendar art. That's the kind of calendar art that people say, you know, kind of makes you think. They'd look at that, and it would be above Mattingly's credit grocery store. See the picture of the Four Freedoms. Or another kind of serious calendar art would be the kind of calendar art that shows this carved picture of these two hands praying. You know, that kind. And they'd say, you know, it kind of makes you think. I mean, they'd see these two. That's serious calendar art. Now, that's another. Now, there was another type of calendar art, and that's the calendar art that existed for the sheer beauty of aesthetic spirit alone. Now, this kind of calendar art usually was the kind of calendar art that showed a pot with flowers in it. Just a pot with flowers. Now, it was never done in the... Van Gogh didn't make that scene because, as my old man would say, I could draw better flowers than them. That's what my old man would say about Van Gogh if he saw the sunflowers. Oh, yeah, sure. Or if you can imagine Paul Klee, still life with daisies or something like that, I can just hear what my old man would say. Ah, come on. When I was in kindergarten, I could draw better flowers than them. That never made it. So they had to be very realistic. They were almost like photographic. In fact, I think most of the paintings were made from a photograph, and there would be a blue pot, and there would be flowers. Now, what kind of flowers were they? Now, you've got to be very important. It's very important to tell you that. They were the most unrealistic, lush-looking, unbelievable, fantastic, passionate-looking American beauty roses. Or gigantic ones. They were just exploding all over the place. And underneath it, it would say, long-stem beauties. That would be the kind of very, very beautiful scene. And people say, isn't that a beautiful calendar? I just love them roses. You know, I'll never forget the time. And a calendar, of course, would always instill or bring out in people remembrances of beauty's experience past. For example, upon viewing such a calendar, a typical comment of one of my aunts would be, I remember the time Fred, do you remember the time, Min, that Fred sent me 6 beautiful American beauty roses? You remember that time? The time that the Lithuanian American Club gave Fred the medal? Do you remember that? And they were, that type of flower brought out, and that type of calendar, I brought out these fantastic, speaking of calendarized, and speaking of the voice of the nebbish on the street, Vox Populi, that reminds me, this is WOR, AM and FM, and part, of course, it's in New York, which is the heart of all this beauty, and you know, speaking of what is, there's more of this stuff rampant here in New York City than there ever was in Hammond, Indiana, but you know, speaking of that kind of beauty, I've noticed that today the electronic version of calendar art, the electronic, the modern Marshall McLuhan version of calendar art, can be found in the commercial. Because after all, the calendar was a commercial. Let's face it, when you got a calendar from Paswinski's Esso station, he was sending you a commercial. Now, he dressed his commercial up with a picture of Granny being helped across. Oh, there were a lot of them. For example, a typical example of the cute calendar art is a nun. This is the typical. I can remember this one now. An apple-cheeked nun who looks a little bit like a cross between Debbie Reynolds and Joan of Arc. There's an apple-cheeked nun, and she's wearing her habit, of course, and she's got it kind of hoisted up a little bit so you can see just the touch of a well-turned ankle. And she is wearing an umpire's mask. And she is umpiring a game, and you can see that it's up to bat is the mother superior. See, this is a very cute type. And our little nun has just called a low inside ball, strike 3 on the mother superior. And crouching down, you see, is this kind of a cute granny type. She's doing the catching. And she's looking roguishly over her left shoulder at the nun who has just called Granny out. She's pointing that the Mother Superior is out. And you can see the Mother Superior's temper coming up. And underneath it, it says, Christian forbearance. You see, that's a typical, now that is a typical, let's put it this way, that is a typical theological calendar. And there were many kinds of that type. We'll go on and on. Now, now these were all commercials. Let's face it. They didn't just send those to you because they thought you'd like a picture of a nun calling the third strike on the Mother Superior. They didn't at all. They sent this to you so that you would remember old Uncle Frank down at Paswinski's Esso station when you wanted your oil changed. It was a commercial, see. And calendar art was always basically commercial, and that's why it was calendar art. And I think that the calendar art of our time is the genuine singing commercial. Nobody really, you know, gets calendars. Nobody hangs a calendar in his house anymore. So the people, instead of the Esso company sending 48 million calendars out to the gas stations, now will send a cute commercial. And that cute commercial is heard on all the transistor radios. And it somehow is endearing. It's endearing in a way, in the same way that the calendar art commercial was endearing in its way. And so that began about the time. I remember when the change came. You know, people used to hate commercials. Now they like them because they're bringing the commercial attitude of the calendar art to the commercial. You know, there used to be a day when the commercial was just a blatant sell. Oh, yeah, the guy said, friends, have you envied those friends of yours, those neighbors of yours, who always have beautiful, wonderful gas heat, who never... So this never made the scene, really. For a while, people used to listen to this, and then they got bugged. And then gradually, that would be the George Washington Hill school of commercial. He's the guy that did all the Lucky Strike stuff back in the days when Lucky Strike had the hit parade, and their commercials were based purely on the abrasive quality. So round, so firm, so fully packed, so free and easy on the draw. Yes, LSMFT, 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 LSMFT. Ooh, you'd sit out there, you know, you'd blow your stack. But that was the abrasive commercial, and that was at about the end of that school. And then suddenly came along the endearing commercial, in which people stopped hating the commercial and began to love the commercial because it was cute. And about that, about the very beginnings of that, how many of you remember Chiquita Banana, ta da ta da da ta? You know, don't you put bananas in the refrigerator? Banana ta ta da ta da ta ta ta. Chiquita Banana was an example of the first kind of commercial that people loved. They dug the commercial, you see. So the Chiquita Banana, I never saw a Chiquita Banana in my life. Is there such a thing? There really is a Chiquita Banana, huh? Well, that was a commercial. I don't know whether it sold any bananas, but it sure sold a hell of a lot of commercials. And so everybody thought, Chiquita Banana. Then there was another commercial that came along about that same time that became very endearing. It was Pepsi Cola hits the spot, 12 full ounces, that's a lot, twice as much for a nickel too. Pepsi Cola is the drink for you. Nickel, 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 nickel. Well, everybody liked that one. Now, what they did something very interesting in a way. They switched from they borrowed a book, they borrowed a page from the book of the guys that sent out the calendar artists. Most calendar artists really were very good artists. I mean, for their style, they were good. They were illustrators. You paid a lot of money to, say, for example, the Norman Rockwell, to send out the Norman Rockwell Four Freedoms. This is a, you know, after all, he's not a cockamamie illustrator. He sells a lot. You know, he's a very important illustrator. And so what they did in the commercial world was to do quite a bit the same thing. They went out and got guys who originally were musical writers, guys who wrote for musicals. In fact, I'll tell you a little story. Maybe I shouldn't even come out with this. I'll tell you a story that a guy who today is represented on Broadway by one of the big hit Broadway musicals is an old friend of mine. And the first time I met this guy, he had graduated from one of America's top musical universities. He had taken, I believe he has a doctorate now in composition, and he had graduated writing, and his thesis, by the way, was a superb sonata, which was and is still being played in concert halls. Really fine performer, and yes, he was a pianist, and he was also a superb composer. Well, he came out of the school, and he was well trained. He'd performed in concert halls himself, and the first thing that happened was he formed a little company where he provided music for any purpose. That is, anybody who wanted good music, very fine composer in a very modern vein, and anybody who wanted good music could come to him. It's an interesting concept at the time. He didn't set up his idea just as to sell commercials. He says, anybody who needs any music for any purpose, come to me. And he even had a name of his company that was somewhat like that. I'm not giving him a plug here tonight, but it was a clever name. So you'd see it listed under music in the yellow book. And under the listing, it would say music provided for any and all purposes. And good, too. So people would go and they'd call up and they'd say, we would like you. Uncle Fred is having a birthday and we want a song written for him. And he would provide us. And he hired three or four song writers, lyric writers, and he wrote the music and performed on it, conducted it, orchestrated it, and produced this stuff. Well, suddenly, commercial guys started. Are you interested in this? Am I boring you? Suddenly, commercial guys started to call him. People who wanted really good music on their commercials. Now, this is a really fine musician. So within about the period of a year, his company became the top creator of commercial music for commercials. And you've heard thousands of his commercials. I know you have. They're the best you've ever heard. He writes great stuff. Well, he became so much in demand that it became almost impossible for him to compose all the music. And so he went out and he recruited other young composers, guys who were coming out of Juilliard and places like Yale. These guys were really serious, hard guys that had studied in Europe. He went around and he recruited half a dozen others, and they began to be a sort of a commercial firm. Really, it was like a General Motors of writing great music for commercials, all kinds of things. So they didn't just stop at commercials. They wrote incidental music for industrial movies. They wrote soundtracks for regular top movies. They wrote all kinds of wild stuff, and they wrote. One of the things they used to do too, as a sideline, was say if you were a top nightclub singer and you wanted really great arrangements of standard songs, really great, interesting arrangements, they would provide these arrangements for you, and they wrote the nightclub acts of a lot of top people. So they really had a business. So one day, I see him in an office, and I said to him, so when are you going to, you know, write a big thing so your name will be famous? You're one of the top, really top composers in the country from a lot of standpoints. When are you going to write something yourself? So he says, you know, I've been thinking about that. He says, as a matter of fact, I've always thought that that was what I always wanted to do in the beginning anyway. And he said, I'm thinking about that. And so for about a year, I never heard much about him. And then one day, I got a call from him, and he says, you know, we've been really working on this. And today, that musical has won about 15 top awards, and he is the hottest single thing in the world. And it's a fine musical, by the way. So when you hear commercials, don't think in terms of just guys' hacks sitting around knocking these things out. That's why I like to parallel a commercial, in a way, with the calendar art of an earlier day, which it provides a peculiar kind of an art form that the people really relate to. Because we're in a materialistic society anyway, let's face it. In fact, all of 20th century man, no matter where you go in most areas, after all, Russia's probably the most materialist. Their whole government is based on a materialist concept of man's place on earth here. So we're not the only one, so don't think America's in a materialist. No. China is becoming more materialistic by the instant. In fact, that's their whole big great leap forward concept is based on materialism. So, yeah, materialism is sweeping the world. People are beginning to say, you know, they want better things to live with. I'm not one of these people who necessarily say that materialism is entirely bad. And so ultimately, the materialist things that you can relate to are quite often the things which provide the really basis, the genuine basis for the art that you will vibrate to. I think one of the reasons that pop art is popular is that it quite often relates to very commercial projects, objects that people live with all their lives. If Andy Warhol, for example, instead of picking his Campbell soup cans originally when he worked, had, say, picked a liver pate can, sells liver pate, he wouldn't have made it. You see, why? Well, because there's a certain amount of basic involvement, really, with Campbell's soup that people feel on a very subliminal, very low, totally true level. So ultimately, these things which we call pop or commercial art really are, in a sense, a vibration produced, a kind of harmonic vibration produced within each one of us about the lives we have lived and the lives we really do live. I think that a man quite often will be far more, and I mean he may even be a very serious man. Now, I'm going to say something probably a lot of people won't like. A very serious man who has spent 9 years studying aesthetics and the value of European art, quite often, subconsciously, will be more excited by the sight of a beautiful Chris Craft cabin cruiser. Really excited. In a very different way. Or let's say excited by the sight of a beautifully designed automobile than he will by the project and the subject that he actually studied and believes in an intellectual way. I remember, man, this is where I learned some of these things. These observations I'm making here come out of experience. And I remember a man I once knew briefly, a strange man, who gathered together the greatest accumulation of European art in America. He had one of the great collections outside of Philadelphia, which is a still famous collection, a world-renowned collection. But I ran into this guy a couple of times in various stores in and around Philadelphia, and I got to the point where I could say hello to him because I had a very exotic automobile at the time, and he was drawn to me because of that exotic automobile. Otherwise, he was known for his curmudgeon-like, hermit-like characteristics. And so I began to see that what really vibrated in this guy's soul was not the great art collection which he collected, which was kind of an abstract beauty, but the 1923 magnificent classic Packard, which he owned, and which he drove around at an insane breakneck speed constantly through red lights, and which eventually was the cause of his eventual demise. However, this is the thing that he really vibrated to, in spite of the fact he had this magnificent collection of art. Now, where does this lead us to? Well, we go into some very, very deep water here. as to what is, let's say we go into deep water, that can be labeled value judgments on degree of excitement. And that's that's a pretty deep water. Now, have you noticed that today many people will talk? Whenever I'm doing a show in any place, I can get people talking more about a commercial than I ever can about the content of the show from which the commercial comes. Very few people can remember the shows they see the Mr. Clean commercials on, but they sure as hell remember Mr. Clean. I think Mr. Clean will rank with some of the great characters created by television. Ultimately, Mr. Clean will have to be in a giant pantheon of fictional characters created by the advertising TV world. He will rank along with such other looming large people as the White Knight. Who can forget that White Knight? I mean, you see that White Knight galloping over the tundra there? And there's a whole world there in front of you, and you relate immediately to it. You don't remember the show, you remember the White Knight. And these things, I may sound very facetious about them, but these things really are great symbols of our time. They are all variations, incidentally, if you noticed, on one way or another, great variations of the Superman theory, the Superman myth. After all, Mr. Clean is a Superman. He's invincible. You cannot imagine Mr. Clean at the end of the commercial not being able to get the dirt off the floor. You cannot imagine Mr. Clean skulking out in defeat. No, because Mr. Clean is a Superman. The White Knight is a Superman. And all heroes, really, have been Superman. The hero that lasts, that will last over the ages as an art form, or as, let's say, as a creation of art, is almost always the Superman. That's what makes me question whether many of our anti-heroes, which people are continually writing today, will have any lasting value. Beowulf is still around. And Beowulf was not, I repeat, was not Woody Allen. So, and I suspect that Beowulf will last a lot longer than Woody Allen. So, on the other hand, you find there's another kind of Superman. There's the Superman of passion, as opposed to the Superman of strength, and that's Captain Ahab. And so Ahab is a classic example of another type of Superman, and he will eventually, of course, he is in the great pantheon of fictional heroes, very much in the same line as represented by people like Beowulf, Richard the Lionhearted, who is, and King Arthur is a greater example. Arthur is part myth and part fact. Nobody quite knows where, but he stands in that great pantheon of classic heroes. A very vaguely troubled one, which makes him even more interesting. And so, ultimately, in his own nutty way, you'll find the people who create in their commercials a Superman will eventually find that character, if it's well contrived, and if it has certain symbols, we can go into symbolic, why certain characters will last and others won't. But did you notice the very close resemblance between Mr. if you remember Mr. Clean, between Mr. Clean and the president who was in the White House at that time? That's right. He emerged during Eisenhower's time, and his resemblance to Eisenhower, friends, was not accidental. And Eisenhower, of course, his rise to greatness and his rise to becoming a national, if not an international, wildly acclaimed hero, came about because of felicitous circumstances of Eisenhower's appearance in many cases, the way he looked, a lot of things about Ike. So Mr. Clean, was working on a well-established track. Have you noticed that since Ike has no longer really he ceased to be an important part of the national pantheon of figures, that Mr. Clean has subtly changed? And now Mr. Clean has expressions on his face, and even his appearance has changed. He doesn't look any more like Ike. There's a lot of reasons for that. All right, don't worry, baby. But the commercial really has become, in a very real sense, has become our calendar art of our day. Now here's a classic example. This commercial, while not having achieved, let's say, great all-time standard status, you know that some commercials are so effective, they achieve a standard. You know what a standard is in the song world? A standard is a song that is really timeless. It's played all the time, and no matter what changes come about in the world of popular music, this song will always be a great song. A classic example of the standard is Stardust. You know, this is a classic example. Another example is Body and Soul. There are dozens of great classical standards, and that has even happened to commercials today. And there is a hallowed hall, a hallowed pantheon of commercials that you'll find on one hand. You'll find nickel, 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 nickel. Use Ajax, boom, boom, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, boom, boom, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Ajax, you all know that song, even though they don't even play it anymore. You don't hear this Ajax song on anymore, but you know it immediately. And when I say, Pepsi-Cola hits the spot, 12 full ounces, that's a lot, twice as much for a nickel. They haven't played this song in a long time, yet it's a standard like Stardust. A Chiquita banana, ta da ta da da ta, ra ta 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 da ta da ta da da ta. These are all standards. Like, see the USA in your Chevrolet, ra ta ta da ta da ta da. There's another standard. And these people who wrote these standards, incidentally, are just as capable of writing a pop standard as they are a commercial standard, which in its way now has become a pop standard. Here's one that is in the second rank of pop standards. Second rank.
Miller High Life, the bright, clear taste in beer. Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer.
There's only one champagne of bottled beer.
This is so much a standard that whenever you hear it, you know exactly what they're singing about.
Miller High Life.
And even though you don't hear what the guy says, you don't know what they're talking about.
A century-old recipe, Miller High Life has a rich heritage and tradition. A bright, clear
taste. That's a standard, you know.
Unequaled, unquestioned, unchanging. Available on tap, in cans, and in familiar crystal-clear bottles. Miller High Life is always sparkling, flavorful, distinctive. Enjoy Miller High Life yourself.
Cha-da-da-da-cha-cha-da. That's a standard.
Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer.
Yes, Miller High Life, the champagne of bottled beer.
You know, I predict we're not yet at that phase. I'm going to make a prediction here. There's been a few abortive attempts. But I'm going to predict that we are going to go through the same wave of nostalgia for the creations of the electronic media. As we have recently gone through the creations of the comic strip media, that I think in about 5 or 6 years, you're going to find people becoming very nostalgic, and I mean in the real sense, over Chiquita Banana. That will represent a simpler, more wonderful Hanseleon youth. Yeah, they will become nostalgic over, and I'll bet there will be games of trivia when people will say, all right, now, okay, Mac, what's this from? Now, listen, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And say, oh, come on, everybody knows Chiquita Banana. Now let's get on with a few other commercials. We're going to be okay. Just be calm. One commercial that I've got here, it's Regal Crown, honey. That's very important. Regal Crown is, for those of you who confuse it, now that's a confusing name. I think they'll do something about it. But Regal Crown are these superb candies imported from England. And they have one of the greatest flavors that I know of. This is my personal flavor that I really dig. They're 10 cents. My personal flavor that I really flip over is that beautiful cherry. They have a cherry flavor that tastes like, and by the way, I also like sour apple, which is a good one. That takes me back to another age. I wonder why they don't bring out a whorehound. I happen to dig this flavor, but not many people do. I think if they brought out a molasses, a bitter molasses one, I think that might sell too. But the next time you step up to your candy counter, say, Regal Crown Sour Grapes, please, and get that rotten look on the face, and they'll know that you're a true believer. 10 cents. And speaking of true believers, and speaking of the British, by the way, sour grapes. I wonder if the British know the meaning that sour grapes has in American slang. Just a curious question. They make this flavor. Speaking of the British, they also make the superb Rover 2000 TC. And if you're looking for an automobile man that is out of sight, in more ways than one, I suggest you send us a note here to Rover, and we'll send you pictures and technical specs of one of the greatest automobiles ever built by the poor, palsied hand of man. This is the Rover 2000 TC, a magnificent machine. And since most of us are in love in one way or another with commercial products, you might as well fall in love with something that is worthy of your love. We suggest the Rover TC 2000.